Chapter 12, Suffer the Children. Weakening the parent-child bond and disintegrating families within a group are a means of subordinating the entire group. Dorothy Roberts. In 1860, the U.S. government began forcibly removing Aboriginal children from their homes and placing them in residential schools far from their families. These schools punished children for speaking their native languages, and physical and sexual abuse were common. Untold numbers died of cold, malnutrition, and disease. Those who made their way home lacked the skills to contribute to their communities. Launched in 1958, the Indian Adoption Project removed over one-third of all Aboriginal children from their families. These and other assaults on the Aboriginal family have left a legacy of domestic violence, addiction, mental illness, and suicide. In Shattered Bonds, The Color of Child Welfare, Dorothy Roberts explains how disrupting family ties is a weapon of social control that has been used since slavery days. Because family loyalties undermined the slave owner's control, slave children were sold apart from their parents, and slave parents were punished in front of their children. As Roberts explains, quote, "Slave law installed the white master as the head of an extended plantation family that included his slaves. Slaves, on the other hand, had no legal authority over their children. Naming a slave after his owner reinforced the child's ultimate subservience to his master rather than to his parents," close quote. After emancipation, black parents tried to reunite with their children. However, plantation owners used apprenticeship laws to keep as many former slaves as they could. In Maryland, 10,000 of the 90,000 emancipated slaves were re-enslaved under apprenticeship laws. It was argued that, quote, "Black children needed the supervision afforded by apprenticeship because the black race was, quote, not prepared for freedom yet," close quote. A key component of blacks' presumed need for continued white supervision was a theory of black parental incompetence. Today, the American prison system and child welfare system are responsible for the largest separation of families since slavery. Half the parents in prison are black, and 90% of the children in long-term foster care have a parent in prison. An estimated 10 million American children have lost a parent to prison at some point in their lives. Parents can be imprisoned in locations far from their children, and children may have no way to visit. Many children of prisoners suffer shock and show symptoms of post-traumatic stress from prolonged separation. According to the Los Angeles-based Center for Children of Incarcerated Parents, quote, "Across the country, an estimated 1.5 million children have a parent behind bars, an increase of more than 500,000 since 1991, according to the Federal Bureau of Justice Statistics. No one knows the exact number, because in virtually every jurisdiction nationwide, no official body, not police, courts, or prisons, is responsible for even asking if prisoners have children. Parent to the nation? How did the state get so much power over families? The doctrine of parens patriae, parent to the nation, originated in feudal England, where the king decided the fate of orphans and others who could not care for themselves. In 1838, this policy was adopted by the United States. Parens patriae gave the state the right to intervene in family life. Social workers, police, and judges could apprehend, detain, interrogate, institutionalize, and adopt out children without the knowledge or consent of their parents. Just as there were more slaves than masters on the plantations, there were also more workers than bosses in the cities. Breaking up families helps to control the urban working class. The Truancy Act of 1853 allowed children to be arrested simply for being poor. That same year, the Reverend Charles Loring Brace founded the New York Children's Aid Society, CAS. to serve as a, quote, moral and physical disinfectant against the multitude of boys swarming now in every foul alley and low street who might come to know their power and use it. During its first 25 years, the CAS received government funding to remove more than 50,000 poor and homeless children from New York City and place them on farms where they were commonly mistreated and overworked. Children sent to reform schools were seldom returned home. Parents seeking to retrieve their children were told that they had been given away. An 1864 Massachusetts state report noted, quote, "We have felt it our duty generally to decline giving children up to their parents and have placed as many of them as we could wish with farmers and mechanics," close quote. The Bill of Rights did not apply to minors until 1967, when the Supreme Court granted them the right to due process. Breaking up families. State policies assumed that those needing government support must be lazy, losers, or cheats. Condemning the poor serves three functions: to blame poverty on the victim and not the system, to justify withholding resources from the working class, and to increase state control over society. The American child welfare system serves all three functions. The underlying philosophy of the present child welfare system is that all families should be able to function adequately without the assistance of society, and that failure to perform the parental role without such assistance is indicative of individual pathology. In America, poverty is considered proof of parental incompetence. It is assumed that parents who care about their kids will find a way to take care of them. In reality, as previous chapters explained, families are pushed into crisis by social policies that overburden them on the one hand and deprive them on the other. To prevent families from seeking government assistance, those that do risk losing their children. Let's look at how this happens. The capitalist system does not provide social support to all. To emphasize that support is not a right, a great deal of effort is spent to distinguish the worthy poor, who presumably deserve relief, from the unworthy poor who do not. The profession of social work was developed for this purpose. Screening families for eligibility gives the state a license to inspect homes, scrutinize lives, and judge parenting practices. It is assumed that the poor are trying to cheat the system. It is never acknowledged that the system is looking for ways to cheat the poor. Social workers are under pressure to separate children from parents. Failing to remove a child who is later harmed can cause a social worker to be disciplined, demoted, fired, and prosecuted. Even when there is no evidence of harm in the present, social workers are urged to remove children on the possibility of harm in the future. To make this decision easier, there is no penalty for wrongfully removing children from their families. Better-off families in crisis can avoid police and social workers because they can pay or have insurance that pays for physicians, therapists, counselors, child care, and so on. In contrast, poor families who are temporarily unable to look after their children can lose them to foster care. The courts view, quote, failing to provide for a child as a parental crime that is equivalent to physical or sexual abuse. Portraying poverty as a parental deficit allows the state to remove children from any poor family. In America, poverty, not maltreatment, is the single most important factor in the decision to place a child in foster care. According to the National Coalition for Child Protection Reform, quote, "Far more common than a child who comes into care because he was beaten are children who come into foster care because the food stamps ran out or because an illness went untreated after parents were kicked off Medicaid or because a single mother trying to stay off welfare could not provide adequate supervision while she worked. Some children are taken just because their parents are down on their luck, out of work, or unable to provide adequate shelter, close quote. The state pays for respite care for foster parents of children with serious mental illness. It does not provide this same relief for biological parents. Some parents with sick children become so desperate that they falsely claim to be neglectful or abusive so their children can enter foster care and receive state-funded medical treatment. A federal investigation found that in 19 states, parents had relinquished custody of more than 12,700 children so they could receive mental health services. Parents who give up their children lose any say over where the child is sent or what kind of treatment is provided. Tragically, despite their parents' sacrifice, many of these children get no treatment at all. In 2003, congressional investigators found that 15,000 children with psychiatric disorders, some as young as 7 years old, were incarcerated in juvenile detention centers because mental health facilities were unavailable. A full 8% of all youth in detention centers were mentally ill youngsters waiting for treatment. Biological parents have parental rights that guarantee them access to their children, even after divorce. Parents of children in foster care enjoy no such protection. On the contrary, seemingly endless bureaucratic hurdles prevent families from reuniting. The courts assume that parents with children in foster care are incompetent until proven otherwise. Psychologists and psychiatrists probe them for character flaws. They must prove they are free of addiction. If they are working, they must have approved child care arrangements. The state imposes housing requirements that discriminate against the poor. A separate bedroom for the parents and different bedrooms for male and female children. At the same time, the state does not provide addiction treatment, accessible child care, or affordable housing. Roberts points out that, quote, inadequate housing is frequently at the center of caseworkers' decision to place children in foster care. Children from families with housing problems are also more likely to stay in the system longer. The court-appointed administrator of the District of Columbia's foster care system determined that as many as half of the children in foster care could be immediately reunited with their parents if housing problems were solved. When reunification takes too long, the courts can permanently terminate the parents' rights. Delay in reunification, not parental fitness, is the most common reason why parents lost all legal rights to their children. Some prominent psychiatrists support breaking the bonds between parents and their children who are in foster care. In Beyond the Best Interests of the Child, Anna Freud, Sigmund Freud's daughter, contends that children can form such strong psychological bonds with their foster parents that serious psychological damage can result when these children are returned to their original families. The bonds that children maintain with their original parents are treated as having little or no value. The option of preserving the child's relationship with both sets of parents is not even considered. On the basis of such, quote, expert advice, American courts regularly deny competent parents custody of their children in favor of continuity of care by foster parents. One Iowa court ruled that a strong bond between parent and child is not an overriding factor in considering whether or not to terminate all parental rights, in effect preventing the birth parents from ever seeing or communicating with their children again. Severing parental rights is supposed to help move foster children into permanent homes. In reality, the number of children available for adoption far exceeds the number of people looking to adopt. Assault on the Black Family. Racism and poverty intersect in the American child welfare system. Proportionally, there are three times as many black children in foster care as there are in the population as a whole. In contrast, there are half as many white children in foster care as there are in the population as a whole. A government-sponsored fact sheet states, No differences have been found in the incidence of child abuse and neglect according to racial group, close quote. If there is no difference in the rate at which black and white parents mistreat their children, why are so many more black children removed from their families? Because of racism, black American families suffer less education, higher unemployment, lower wages, more medical problems, and less access to medical care than white families. About 54% of black children live below the poverty line, compared with 15% of white children. As a result, blacks are more likely to live in substandard housing in unsafe neighborhoods. Racism also causes black parents to be scrutinized more often and more harshly than white parents. Black families are more likely to be reported than white families when their children suffer the same injuries. A Florida study of pregnant women found that the rate of drug abuse was similar for black and white women. Yet 10 times as many black women were reported to government authorities for drug use. Black children were more likely to be placed in foster care even when their parents were employed, drug-free, and not receiving welfare. Even when they came from small families in safe neighborhoods, and even when they had no disabilities or mental health problems. Roberts points out that once black children are removed from their families, they remain in foster care longer, are moved more often, receive fewer services, and are less likely to be either returned home or adopted than other children. The double whammy of racism and poverty results in a predominantly black foster care population. In New York City, one of every 22 black children is in foster care. In Central Harlem, one of every 10 children is in foster care. In Chicago, 95% of the children in foster care are black. Almost all Chicago families who have lost their children are clustered in two zip code areas that are very poor and almost exclusively black. Roberts concludes, quote, "Placing so many black children in the state's custody implements the quintessential racist insult that black people are incapable of governing themselves and need white supervision," close quote. Malcolm X, whose own family was dismembered by the welfare system, called it nothing but legal modern slavery, however kindly intentioned. Saving children. The strongest argument for taking children from their families is to remove them from danger. How much harm does the child welfare system prevent? Roberts explains that, quote, "For every child placed in foster care because she was malnourished or unsupervised, there are hundreds more who suffer the same deprivations. The system haphazardly picks out a fraction of families to bludgeon, while it leaves untouched the conditions that are really most damaging to children," close quote. In 2003, 18% of American children were living below the official poverty level of $18,810 for a family of four. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, poverty is the most important cause of child maltreatment. Child abuse is 14 times more common, and child neglect is 44 times more common in families with annual incomes under $15,000, compared with families whose annual incomes are over $30,000. The best way to prevent child maltreatment would be to raise family incomes and improve social services. However, the child welfare system emphasizes punishment over support. As a result, parents who fear they might harm or be unable to provide sufficiently for their children are less likely to seek help. Concerned relatives will hesitate to contact an agency if doing so might result in the loss of the child. When caseworkers are kept busy supervising families simply because they're poor, the children who are in real danger of being harmed or killed by their parents are more likely to fall through the cracks. The recommended standard for social workers is no more than 17 cases at any one time. In Newark, New Jersey, a 7-year-old boy died and his two brothers were found almost starved. The worker assigned to that family had over 100 children in her caseload and was working nights, weekends, and holidays. Sometimes children need to be removed from dangerous families, and the state does provide some children with safer places. However, even more are removed from the frying pan and dumped into the fire. Imagine the agony of parents whose children are taken from them, supposedly for their own good, only to die in foster care. In Los Angeles, the pipes in a grandmother's rented house burst, flooding the basement and making the home a health hazard. Instead of helping the family find another place to live, child protective workers take away the granddaughter and place her in foster care. She dies there, allegedly killed by her foster mother. The child welfare agency that would spend nothing to move the family offers $5,000 for the funeral. Social agencies are quick to prosecute birth parents for child abuse, while ignoring the more serious problem of foster parent abuse. National data on child abuse fatalities show that a child is twice as likely to die of abuse in foster care as in the general population. A study of reported abuse in Baltimore found the rate of substantiated cases of sexual abuse in foster care more than four times higher than the rate in the general population. State-run group homes and orphanages have a horrific record of child neglect and abuse. A 1997 Los Angeles County grand jury report found that, quote, many of the nearly 5,000 foster children housed in Los Angeles County group homes are physically abused and drugged excessively while being forced to live without proper food, clothing, education, and counseling, close quote. An investigation of all 50 states did not find one that was fully compliant with federal standards for protecting children. The state is an incompetent parent. A 1991 national survey found that 46% of former foster children did not complete high school and 51% were unemployed. More recent studies have found similar results. 30% of the nation's homeless population were in foster care as children. The welfare of children should not be entrusted to a state that impoverishes families and then removes their children, only to neglect, abuse, and abandon them. Poverty is the greatest source of childhood trauma. In the United States, 13 million children and youth live in poverty. 17% of American children do not receive adequate nutrition. The state gives billions of dollars in tax cuts to the capitalist class, while turning children into the largest destitute group in the nation. For this reason alone, the state is the single greatest perpetrator of child abuse. Welfare as social control. In The Children of Neglect, Margaret Smith and Rowena Fong conclude, quote, the traditional view of both poverty and child neglect is that they are due to personal problems of parents and therefore not the responsibility of the community to resolve. Thus, children are condemned to live in poverty because the child welfare system is about the culpability of parents, not about providing resources to resolve the issues associated with poverty, close quote. The Social Security Act of 1935 entitled poor families to social assistance as long as they needed it. In 1996, the Clinton administration placed a time limit on how long anyone could get welfare, regardless of need. Families that exceed their time limit and become destitute can lose their children to foster care. Ironically, the state pays foster parents twice as much to look after other people's children as it pays biological parents to look after their own children. The Clinton welfare laws also require welfare recipients to find waged work. Most women on welfare are single parents, yet the state provides no funds for child care. In New York City, most of the families investigated for, quote, lack of supervision had no access to affordable child care. In Genesee County, Michigan, which includes Flint, the foster care population has doubled. One of the main reasons is they're removing children from women forced to leave their children with unsuitable caretakers while they go to jobs they must take under the state's welfare laws. The state won't provide adequate welfare because the capitalist class needs a low-waged workforce, and people won't work for low wages if social assistance is available. Most importantly, the working class cannot be allowed to think it has a right to anything. As a result, the state spends more money to break up families than it spends to keep them together. A 1998 Michigan Auditor General report found that the average cost for family preservation services was $4,367 per family, compared to the annual cost per child of $12,384 for foster care and $56,206 for institutional care. Welfare policies are not designed to help people. They are designed to help the state control the dangerous classes. The threat of losing financial support instills fear and submission in the needy. Funding religious organizations to deliver aid to the poor adds another layer of control. Forcing people to submit to religious doctrine as a condition of receiving support. While welfare policies target the poorest families, the entire working class gets the message. Don't expect any help from the state. Teach them their place. Education as social control goes back to slavery days, when it was a crime to teach black slaves to read and write. By the time slavery was legally abolished in 1863, more than 95% of blacks were illiterate. Newly freed slaves were hungry to learn. Few were too young and none were too old to make the attempt to learn. As fast as any kind of teachers could be secured, not only were day schools filled, but night schools as well. Day school, night school, and Sunday school were always crowded, and often many had to be turned away for want of room. Teachers flooded down from the north. However, the southern establishment tried to block their efforts. Quote, in the interior of Texas, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Maryland, Negroes were disposed of their school buildings. Teachers were not allowed to enter upon their duties, and churches and schoolhouses were sometimes burned, close quote. The black civil rights movement won the legal integration of public schools in the 1950s. However, the employer's offensive has eroded that victory. As the courts lifted desegregation laws and attacked affirmative action, the proportion of black students attending integrated schools dropped. In Chicago today, almost 90% of public school students are black or Latino. In The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America, Jonathan Kozol explains how education funding policies perpetuate a race-segregated school system. Education is funded primarily through property taxes, so schools in poor neighborhoods are starved for money, teachers, books, and other resources. Because of racism, blacks and Hispanics are more likely to live in poor neighborhoods. A vicious cycle is created where black and Latino children are deprived of educational opportunities that could help them get better-paying jobs as adults. The education system is designed to keep all working-class people down. Before industrial capitalism, young people learned by watching and listening, by exploring the world on their own, by apprenticing themselves to those who had something to teach them, and by trial and error. This kind of learning, directed by curiosity and embedded in society, is incompatible with a work system that demands repetitive movements and unquestioning obedience. In The Underground History of American Education, John Taylor Gatto explains that the modern school system developed in response to working-class rebellions that shook capitalism in 1848 and again after World War I. The ruling class needed a school system to keep the masses in their place, working for capitalism. This was no secret conspiracy. President Woodrow Wilson announced, quote, "We want one class to have a liberal education. We want another class, a very much larger class of necessity, to forego the privilege of a liberal education and fit themselves to perform specific, difficult, manual tasks, close quote. To preserve the class system, schools teach children only what they will need to do their future jobs and no more. A few creative, critical thinkers are needed at the management and professional level. However, the majority are expected to work in low-waged, mind-numbing jobs. These students cannot be allowed to develop their potential. William Torrey Harris, U.S. Commissioner of Education, between 1889 and 1906, writes approvingly, quote, 99 students out of 100 are automata, careful to walk in prescribed paths, careful to follow the prescribed custom. This is not an accident, but the result of substantial education, which, scientifically defined, is the subsumption of the individual, close quote. The de-skilling of work has been accompanied by a rising rate of illiteracy. Based on American military testing, 98% of adult men could read or write in the 1930s. By World War II, this number had dropped to 96%. During the Korean War, the literacy rate declined to 81%. By 1973, only 73% of recruits for the Vietnam War had a minimal level of literacy. Literacy rates have fallen faster for whites than for blacks. Between 1940 and 1992, black illiteracy doubled, while white illiteracy quadrupled. A 1992 nationwide survey conducted by the U.S. Department of Education found that 21% of the adult population did not have basic reading and writing skills, and 8 million people were unable to perform even the simplest literacy tasks. A 2003 survey found that prose literacy among adults had fallen at every level of education. Is the school system failing? In Dumbing Us Down, The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling, John Taylor Gatto quotes David Albert, "Schools are not failing. On the contrary, they are spectacularly successful in doing precisely what they are intended to do, and what they have been intended to do since their inception. The school system, perfected at places like the University of Chicago, Columbia Teachers College, Carnegie Mellon, and Harvard, and funded by the captains of industry, was explicitly set up to ensure a docile, malleable workforce to meet the growing, changing demands of corporate capitalism." Close quote. In Savage Inequalities, Children in America's Schools, Jonathan Kozol explains how working-class youth are denied education. Schools in more affluent areas can hire the best teachers and provide the most engaging learning experiences. Schools starved of funds cannot feed hungry minds. In some states, the difference between rich and poor schools is more than $2,000 per student per year. The U.S. has one of the highest high school dropout rates in the industrialized world. Only 2/3 of all students and only half of minority students graduate from high school. In New York City, only 18% of students and 9% of black students qualify for admission to college. These statistics are the results of a school system that preserves racial and class inequalities, providing just enough education to prepare children for their predetermined roles in society. Youngsters naturally resent such unfairness. Kozol quotes a high school student from the South Bronx. "Most of the students in this school won't go to college. Many of them will join the military. If there's a war, we have to fight. Why should I go to war and fight for opportunities I can't enjoy, for things rich people value, for their freedom? But I do not have that freedom, and I can't go to their schools." Close quote. What did you learn in school today? In 1964, Tom Paxton wrote, "What Did You Learn in School Today?, a song that describes how schools create a distorted view of the world. History lessons highlight the deeds of great men and ignore the contributions of regular folks. The message is that ordinary people have nothing to offer society. 11-year-old Oliver Maynard Langadyke recounts his experience. Quote, I came into school and most of my friends had their backpacks on. I asked them where they were going and they told me it was a special kids' trip to this comic book convention. The principal selected them. Most of them had something special about them. They were really quiet or they were really, really smart. I don't know. No one told me how they got to go. It made me feel left out. The other kids who didn't get to go felt the same as me. I was really mad, so I told my mom. Some other parents were mad, too, so they all went to the principal, and he said he wouldn't do it again, but they did. Close quote. Oliver is learning that some people get special privileges and others don't, and that you're not supposed to question this arrangement. He's learning that people in authority do as they please, that they cannot be trusted, and that parents are powerless against them. The school system is designed to teach these lessons to working-class children. A few students, those who seem eager to please the authorities, are groomed for professional training. The rest are channeled into low-paying jobs. To prepare youngsters for life under capitalism, schools must discipline children to obey without question, think and do as we say. Pressure children to conform to external expectations. Be who we want you to be. Accustom children to competition. Fight over the crumbs we throw you. Grade and sort children into categories based on future functions. Adapt to the needs of the machine. Groom a few students to manage and control the others. Workers need managers. Degrade and humiliate the rest for not being good enough. You don't deserve better. Schools teach dissociation. To accomplish the tasks listed above, schools must remove children from sources of independent learning. Huck Finn did not attend school, and look at the trouble he got into, freeing a slave and all. Homework ensures that children stay busy with school-directed chores. For most children, school attendance is compulsory. There is no choice. Schools claim to help children fulfill their creative and intellectual potential. In practice, most schools are run like assembly line factories without regard for students' needs. Government-mandated programs and standardized testing demand that every child learn the same thing at the same time in the same way. As one Los Angeles principal told his teachers, quote, when I stand in the hallway, I should be able to hear all fourth grade teachers saying the same thing. Do not deviate from the scripted program and do not fall behind in the pacing plan, close quote. To condition them for the workplace, students are trained to obey the clock. Bells ring periodically to signal a change of station. At the ring of the bell, students must drop what they are doing and move to the next classrooms. No thought, conversation, or project can continue beyond the time allotted. When concentration is continually interrupted, only now matters. Repeated disengagements of this kind teach children not to think too long or care too much about anything. Television reinforces the immediate and the temporary. Politicians appreciate voters who don't recall past betrayals. Schools promote dissociation when they divide subjects into arbitrary categories with no seeming connection, divorce facts from their historical context, and make no effort to relate material to the child's world. Large numbers of students in each classroom keep teachers busy enforcing discipline instead of responding to students' individual needs. Schools teach children to rely on and take direction only from experts. Students confined in age-segregated classrooms can neither learn from older children nor teach younger ones. They must sit quietly and not talk to one another. Only the teacher is presumed to have anything important to say. Students are not allowed to speak, to move from their seats, or to go to the toilet without permission. Big Brother surveillance reinforces authoritarian control. In 2002, 3/4 of the 950 new public schools that opened across America were equipped with spy cameras. Continual electronic monitoring of classrooms and corridors sends the message that youngsters cannot be trusted. Schools enforce the rules that govern male and female behavior. Males are shamed for being quiet or emotional, while females are shamed for being loud or aggressive. Males are groomed to act tough and disdain everything female, while females are pressured to look sexy and defer to males. No ambiguity is tolerated. Rigid sex role expectations keep children focused on their performance. The more they censor themselves, the less they relate to each other in genuine ways. These rigid sex roles that are reinforced throughout life block compassion, prevent intimacy, and contribute to marriage breakdown. Schools teach bigotry and intolerance. The Human Rights Watch publication Hatred in the Hallways, Violence and Discrimination Against Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Students in U.S. Schools explains how more than 2 million school-age youth in the United States, who are different from the majority of their peers, soon learn that the principle of equality does not apply to them. In one Iowa school, gay students reported hearing anti-gay epithets about every 7 minutes. The report condemns the abject failure of the United States government to protect lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender youth who attend public schools from harassment and violence. Government, at the local, state, and federal levels, has refused to dismantle laws and policies and to eliminate the practice that effectively discriminate against these youth. Close quote. Bullying 101. A 1998 survey of more than 15,500 public and private schools in the grades 6 through 10 found that 40% of boys and 30% of girls had been bullied in school. About half of the boys and 1/3 of the girls reported that they bullied others. Most were bullies and victims at different times. Why is bullying so common among young people? Children learn by mimicking adults. Schoolyard bullying fits in with a world where might makes right, regardless of what adults say. In response to the 1999 shooting at Columbine High School, President Bill Clinton pleaded on national television, "We must teach our children to resolve their differences with words, not weapons." While the president was preaching nonviolence, the U.S. military was bombing Yugoslavia. Children are keen observers, and they copy what adults do. In 2002, a bystander videotaped 4 police officers beat a handcuffed black teenager, drag him along the ground, and slam him against a police car. What provoked this savage attack? 16-year-old Donovan Jackson was slightly built and had hearing and speech problems. It seems that the officers became enraged when the youngster did not respond quickly enough to their verbal commands. Actions speak louder than words. A do-as-I-say-not-as-I-do model of behavior establishes 2 standards, one for those with more power and a different one for those with less power. The lesson is not lost on children who practice the 3 roles of powerful persecutor, helpless victim, and passive bystander. These roles are acted out at home when parents attack each other and children feel helpless to intervene. When a parent singles out one child for punishment and forces the rest to watch. And when a parent punishes a child over the protests of the other parent. In the classroom, the teacher humiliates one student to discipline them all. In the workplace, management targets a few workers to control the rest. On a world scale, stronger nations destroy weaker ones to demonstrate their power. Schoolyard bullying is a copycat response to the bullying that saturates the child's world. The most effective response to bullying is for people to unite against it. Schools don't want youngsters learning this lesson. 8th grader Anthony Soltero stood up to the bullies in March of 2006 when he helped to organize a student walkout in Los Angeles to protest anti-immigrant legislation. After the march, the school administrator threatened to send Anthony to jail for 3 years and fine his mother $250. In despair, Anthony killed himself. To honor Saltero's commitment to justice, L.A. students organized another march for immigrant rights and called on students across the country to do the same. Winners and losers. I'm the king of the castle and you're the dirty rascal. Every child has proudly chanted this ditty on top of the tallest mound and has also been humiliated by someone else who got there first. Through games and chants, preschool children prepare for a world of competition. As soon as they enter school, they are immersed in win-lose situations. By means of tests, contests, games, and sports, teachers evaluate, rank, and sort youngsters, advancing the winners and degrading the losers. Schools hold out the promise that hard work will be rewarded, but win-lose competitions teach children otherwise. My 6-year-old grandson loves to spell, and he works hard at it. One day he came home from school dejected. He had spelled 2 words wrong and was denied a gold star. His mother reassured him, but he remained sullen. After dinner, he hit his sister. When reprimanded, he began to howl and would not be consoled. Children have an innate sense of fairness and know when promises are not kept. It's not fair. My grandson was learning that hard work counts only when it results in perfection. There is no recognition for hard work or for learning through trial and error. He was treated like a loser, and that made him angry. As Oliver observed, you feel mad, so you take it out on other people. Schools produce bored and angry children. When adults reward the efforts of only a few children, those who see their efforts ignored or belittled lose interest in learning. Children who cannot win at school will compensate by trying to win the recognition of their peers, often by defying the system that is excluding and humiliating them. Uncooperative and misbehaving children are like red flags that signal serious social problems. When children have problems with school, teachers and parents are blamed. Teachers are squeezed between the needs of their students and the demands of the administration. If they provide engaging opportunities for children to learn, they are disciplined for not following the curriculum. If they impose the curriculum, they become the enemies of the students. Parents are treated like extensions of the school. They are supposed to make their children do homework and provide extra support for those who fall behind. When children rebel, parents are pressured to give them drugs to make them more compliant. Say yes to our drugs. The school system neglects, oppresses, and humiliates children, then labels those who rebel as sick or defective. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM, considers child rebellion to be a sign of mental illness. Conduct disorder and oppositional defiant disorder are psychiatric diagnoses listed under the category of disruptive behavior disorders. The following study exposed how absurd these diagnoses are. In North Carolina, a gambling casino opened midway through an 8-year study of child psychiatric illness. Because the casino was owned by the First Nations, it paid each Aboriginal family a financial bonus that rose every year. These payments elevated 14% of the families out of poverty, while 53% remained poor. 32% of the families were not poor to begin with. Before the casino opened, the poor children had more than 4 times as many psychiatric symptoms as the children who had never been poor. After the casino opened, psychiatric symptoms among children who were no longer poor fell to the same level as children who had never been poor. In contrast, psychiatric symptoms remained high among the children who remained poor. Similar results were found in non-Aboriginal children whose families moved out of poverty during the same period. Why would rising income levels solve child behavior problems? Chapter 7 explained that all children have difficulty regulating emotions. At times, all children are impulsive, hyperactive, aggressive, and defiant. Supportive adults must teach children how to manage their feelings. Deprived and overly stressed parents cannot do this. The resulting child misbehavior signals a crisis in the family. Money does not solve all family problems. However, it can meet enough of the parents' needs so that they, in turn, can meet their children's needs. Unfortunately, society refuses to support families and drugs kids instead. Cuts in funding for education, family support, and child services have led to an escalation in the number of children being prescribed psychiatric drugs. The psychiatric diagnosis of attention deficit disorder, ADD, also called attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, was created to permit doctors to drug children who act out in school. Drug prescriptions for school-aged children peak in September and drop in June, the duration of the school year. One program offered an alternative to drug treatment. A trained social worker met weekly at home and at school with the child diagnosed with ADD and their parents. While they were participating in this program, none of the children needed medication. When funding for the program ended, all the children began to have problems and went back on medication. The drugs most commonly prescribed for ADD are powerful stimulants, like amphetamines and Ritalin. According to the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, quote, "In clinical studies, neither humans nor animals can tell the difference between cocaine, amphetamine, or methylphenidate when they are administered in the same way at comparable doses. In short, they produce effects that are nearly identical." Close quote. Between 1991 and 1999, U.S. production of amphetamines increased more than 2,000%, and sales of methylphenidate, Ritalin, increased nearly 500%. About 80% of all prescriptions for these drugs are for children diagnosed with ADD. In some areas, 1 in 4 school children is taking these drugs. Twice as many boys are given drugs for ADD compared with girls, who are more likely to be given antidepressants. Every year, an estimated 500,000 American children are prescribed antidepressant drugs. A national survey found that increasing numbers of children are also being prescribed antipsychotic drugs that have been linked with serious health problems. In 1993, 275 children out of 100,000 were taking these drugs. By 2002, the number had risen to 1,438 out of every 100,000 children. While politicians call for a drug-free America, the nation's children are being drugged at an unprecedented rate. The American Academy of Pediatrics estimates that between 4 and 12% of school-aged children suffer from ADD. It is more likely that politicians and bureaucrats are afflicted with ADD because they pay no attention to the harm caused by their slash-and-burn social policies. In contrast, children are fully aware of their suffering, and they protest it in the only ways they can, with anger, agitation, anxiety, depression, and defiance. Who hears the cries of our children? Teachers are tied to a restrictive curriculum and deprived of resources. Doctors prescribe drugs instead of protesting oppressive conditions. Courts force children to take mood-altering drugs. Parents who refuse to medicate their kids have been charged with child abuse and threatened with losing custody. When medication fails, there is always punishment. School is prison. We are breeding a generation of children who think they are criminals for the way they are being treated in school. School used to be a refuge. Now it's a lockdown environment. We are bringing the practice of criminal justice into the schools. Annette Fuentes. Today's youngsters are being criminalized by policies of zero tolerance in schools. Making mistakes is human and unavoidable, especially during adolescence, which is a time to explore and experiment. By forcing youngsters into behavioral straitjackets, zero tolerance policies invite rebellion, beginning a cycle of punishment and defiance that turns children into criminals. Students in Texas can be suspended for, quote, cheating, violating dress codes, horseplay, excessive noise, and failure to bring homework to class, close quote. Because student suspensions are reported to the County Juvenile Justice Board, a child could be saddled with a criminal record for being rowdy. In 2003, journalist Annette Fuentes investigated the impact of zero-tolerance policies in public schools. Every year, more than 3 million students are suspended, and nearly 100,000 more are expelled from kindergarten through 12th grade. Of those, untold thousands face police action for disciplinary problems that were previously handled in school, because 41 states now require that certain acts committed in school be reported to the police, close quote. Boys are the primary targets, and black males are singled out. Even though they do not break the rules more often, 2 to 3 times more black students than white students are suspended from school. African American students are 17% of the entire public school population, but account for 34% of all out-of-school suspensions and 30% of expulsions. White students, by contrast, are 62% of the student population, but account for 48% of out-of-school suspensions and 49% of expulsions. Zero-tolerance policies are enforced by police, police dogs, and metal detectors in schools that feel like prisons. Public officials insist that such heavy-handedness is necessary to prevent youth crime. In fact, rates of school violence are much lower now than when the parents of today's youth were in school. There is only a 1 in 2 million chance of anyone being killed at school. 75% of all murders of youngsters under age 18 are committed by adults. One would never know this from the media. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Demonizing youth. Portraying youngsters as criminals helps to justify more police, more prisons, and more social control. In 1995, John DeLulio of Princeton University wrote, The Coming of Super Predators, in which he predicted the rise of an especially violent type of juvenile criminal. In 1996, Bill Bennett, co-chair of the Council on Crime in America, predicted that, quote, America is a ticking violent crime bomb. Rates of violent juvenile crime and weapons offenses have been increasing dramatically, and by the year 2000 could spiral out of control, close quote. In 1997, Florida Congressman William McCollum stated that today's youth are, quote, the most dangerous criminals on the face of the earth. The facts said otherwise. Crimes committed by young people had been falling for years. According to FBI statistics, in 1999, the year of the Columbine High School shooting, incidents of school violence and juvenile violent crime had hit their lowest level in 20 years. There had been an increase in youth embezzlement. Perhaps DeLulio should have titled his report, The Coming of the Super Embezzlers, but people might have thought he was referring to corporate America. In The Myth of the Grade School Murderer, Mike Males provides the following statistics. Quote, in raw numbers, about 60 grade school kids were arrested every year for homicide during the 1960s. 70 per year during the 1970s, 40 per year in the 1980s and 1990s, and just 22 in 1998 and 17 in 1999. A grade school child was arrested for murder once a week on average in the halcyon days of 1965, when Father Knows Best and I Want to Hold Your Hand ruled the airwaves. Today, when ultra-violent video games, slasher movies, gangster rap, explicit TV, internet savagery, more poverty, and family disarray, and automatic firearms are rampant, grade school kids are 65% less likely to murder, close quote. Despite the facts, the mainstream media revel in the image of youngsters as dangerous criminals. A group of New York high school students studied the New York Times coverage of youth and crime. They found that over a three-month period, 54% of articles portrayed youth as perpetrators of crimes, and 44% portrayed them as victims of crime. A study of the San Francisco Chronicle found that stories on youth and crime portrayed youth as perpetrators almost 75% of the time. The hype against youngsters is so effective that when people hear the words youth and violence, they think of youth as violence, not as victims of violence. Test this yourself. In reality, young people are victims of violent crime more than 12 times more often than they are perpetrators. The media all but ignores the estimated 2,000 deaths and 475,000 incidents of violence that adults inflict on youngsters every year. What about teen drug abuse? Adults suffer far more drug abuse and addiction than young people. 80% of drug overdose deaths occur in people over 30 years of age. Fewer than 3% of these deaths occur in people under age 20. Today's 40-year-olds are three times more likely to suffer serious illegal drug abuse problems than today's 16-year-olds. Males concludes, quote, "Nearly all the imagined youth crises of today, from guns to heroin to suicide, are hallucinations. The fastest growing population in terms of drug abuse, criminal arrest for violent property and drug offenses, and imprisonment is persons aged 35 to 59, mostly white. Teens comprise perhaps 2% of America's drug problem, but 90% of the raging controversy over drug use. That is scapegoating." Close quote. The flood of negative hype against youngsters has an impact. A 1999 survey found that most adults in the United States have disapproving and negative attitudes toward teenagers, and most believe that the next generation will not make the world a better place. By demonizing young people, the ruling class drives a wedge between the generations. When people lose faith in the future, they resign themselves to the way things are. During the 1960s, schools and communities provided a variety of music, art, and athletic programs for young people. Since then, cuts to social programs have left many youngsters with no organized activities. As a result, 75% of teens report hanging out with their friends with nothing specific to do. No one thinks twice when adults hang out with their friends. However, teens are condemned for doing the same thing. When parents are working 2 and 3 jobs, peer acceptance becomes more important for young people. Instead of condemning the lack of social support for youngsters, politicians and the media condemn youth gangs and call for a crackdown on young people, including harsher penalties, trying youngsters as adults, and jailing them in adult prisons. Between 1994 and 2000, the rate of juvenile violent crimes fell 40% in the U.S., and the juvenile homicide rate fell 70%. Yet from 1990 to 1999, the number of incarcerated juveniles rose 74%. Juvenile detention centers are filled with children convicted of underage drinking and smoking, truancy, breaking curfew, running away, and other minor offenses that are illegal only for minors. The racism of the adult prison system extends to the youth prison system. Between 1988 and 1997, the rate of increase in detentions for black youth was more than double the rate of increase for white youth. In 1997, judges sent 27% of black delinquents to juvenile prisons compared with just 15% of white delinquents. Young people of color form one-third of the total youth population and two-thirds of youngsters in criminal detention. A two-way conveyor belt runs between the foster care and prison systems. Dorothy Roberts observes, quote, "The prison system supplies children to the child welfare system when it incarcerates their parents. The child welfare system then supplies young adults to the prison system when it abandons them after years in foster care," close quote. Foster children form fewer than 2% of the general population, yet they make up 15% of all the children in detention. In some states, the rates are much higher. In Connecticut, 75% of youth in the state criminal justice system had been in foster care. In Illinois, 80% of adult prisoners were in foster care as children. All 50 states allow juveniles to be tried as adults. Young defendants are less likely to have adequate legal representation, with the result that youth sentences average 60% longer than adult sentences for the same crimes. In 1999, 12-year-old Lionel Tate killed his 6-year-old playmate while showing her wrestling moves he'd seen on television. He was tried as an adult and convicted of first-degree murder. When he was 13 years old, a Florida court sentenced him to life in prison. Young black males like Tate are 3 times more likely to be charged with violent crimes, 6 times more likely to be tried in adult court, and 7 times more likely to be sentenced to prison when they are tried as adults. Frightened, defenseless, subject to all manner of abuse, children in adult jails are up to 8 times more likely to kill themselves than those held in juvenile detention centers. Nothing condemns capitalism more than its barbaric treatment of children. The kids are all right. Children are the future. Despite efforts to drive a wedge between the generations, most adults think that helping kids get a good start in life is extremely important, more important than preventing crime. 75% of adults agree that, quote, "given enough help and attention, just about all kids can learn and succeed in school," close quote. 89% think that, quote, "given enough attention and the right kind of guidance, almost all teenagers can get back on track," close quote. This belief in youngsters runs counter to social policies that treat troubled youth as unmanageable and in need of harsh punishment. Young people deserve support and admiration. What society gives them instead is neglect and abuse. The powers that be fear the energy and moral indignation of youth. Young people who organize against injustice are maligned by the media and assaulted by police. Some are even killed as a warning to the rest. When 23-year-old Carlo Giuliani was murdered by police during a demonstration in Genoa, Italy, his father praised him. Quote, "Carlo was the exact opposite of what people have written about him. He was a boy of great generosity who was opposed to injustice. He read, studied, he discussed, and he protested for his ideas. He always cared about others. He always worked, if irregularly. He worked in the jobs that all young people are forced to take, in the black economy, without any security, without any rights. Carlo didn't accept the notion that 8 leaders of the world should decide the life and death of hundreds of thousands of people," close quote. In the story of the emperor who wore no clothes, the adults admired the emperor's invisible threads, while the child could see that he was stark naked. When the child spoke up, the adults were faced with a choice. Should they confront the emperor or force the child to conform? The next chapter explains why it is necessary to take sides. Summary. A society that oppresses the majority must also oppress its children. Children question everything and do not tolerate injustice. To maintain the status quo, the potential of youth to build a better world must be suppressed. Schools demand subservience to prepare most youngsters for low-wage work. Youth who rebel against their oppression are slandered by the media, torn from their families, drugged by doctors, brutalized by authorities, and incarcerated by the state. Despite efforts to drive a wedge between the generations, belief in the potential of youth remains strong and provides hope for the future. And that concludes Chapter 12 and Part 3 of Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal.